This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. It's a comedy that relays the pitiful story of Semyon, a man whose only choices are to learn to play the tuba or end it all. When he makes his choice, all of Russia weighs in on how to make his sad life have meaning. The underknown 20th century comedy classic, Dying for It, by Moira Bufini, is actually a free adaptation of the late Russian author Nikolai Erdman's classic, The Suicide. It comes to the Triad courtesy of UNC School of the Arts. School of Drama faculty Timothy Douglas will direct a cast of talented UNCSA fourth-year drama students. Timothy is associate artist at Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park, and he's led productions at professional theater companies across the U.S., including the Guthrie, Steppenwolf, and Milwaukee Rep.
I love a political satire. The play is very, very funny, but equally has quite a bite to it. And that bite almost happens after you've laughed. You're not even sure if did that mean what I thought it meant. Semyon is an everyman, and he cannot find work. And he's being supported by his wife, whom he adores, and his mother-in-law. And, you know, traditionally as a man, he feels emasculated because he can't find work. He can't take care of his basic needs, much less his family. And in a moment of frustration, he proclaims out loud, maybe it would be better for everyone if I would just off myself. We've said things like that in moments of frustration, but he is believed and word gets out. And at a time where everyone is feeling desperation, they figure, well, if he's going to kill himself, maybe I can convince himself to kill himself for my cause. I'll make sure his family is taken care of, and then my cause will be heard. So it's about appropriation. It's about mixed ideals in a culture or class of people who don't know which end is up. There's a comedy of errors when you get these people together in the room, but then you realize it's all motivated from a place of desperation. We have the luxury watching of laughing, but the characters going through, the actors themselves, are not playing for laughs at all.
The play was banned until 1982 in Russia. Erdman never saw the piece produced. I mean, he died some years before then.
Correct.
What was so scandalous about it that would make them suppress it to that extent?
Well, I think initially the play got by the censors because they saw how ridiculous it was. But when it's spoken out loud, and one of the things the character of Aristarch Dominikovich talks about is a dead man can say things that a living man can't. Mm. And Semyon, committed to killing himself, flouts the government to its face. But do you take that person seriously because they're about to die? But his commitment, or the perceived commitment to take his own life as a political stand, empowers those around him. And when the government censors realized that, they had to shut it down.
Interesting.
Because individual power was no longer in vogue after the revolution.
Just a point of entry is this whole concept of a comedy about suicide, essentially, where someone who just sees that and says, wow, what a bizarre concept. I mean, that biting wit, that dry sarcasm, could you kind of speak to that a little bit from your experience?
Well, I think we can get away with it in this culture because, at large, we don't like talking about death in any capacity. We don't like looking at it. Every effort is made to hide it from the living. So because it's not something we want to deal with or is in a daily conversation, it's this mystery topic. And so its amorphous nature allows us to dangle in there and to run around in there like, you know, untended children, creating mayhem because very few are going to call us on it. So as we investigate this idea of suicide and its benefits to others after the deceased is out of the way. Not only are we making fun of it, but we're looking at the seriousness of it. It's a constant conversation between myself and the actor playing Semyon, a wonderfully talented actor by the name of David Zaldivar. They're all gifted, of course, but he has the lion's share of the show, and it's a topic he just hasn't thought about. And how to balance what is mischievously fun about this play with that individual's contemplation with his own mortality, and he happens to be very young. So all of that dynamic is folded into this production, and I would imagine that there may be sections of the audience who won't be able to laugh at this play, but not because they're not engaged by it.
The story now regarded as a 20th century classic comedy. What sorts of liberties have been taken? Did Moira take Moira Bufini with the play The Suicide. It's been described as being beautifully written. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a production of this. Tell me about Moira.
She's a remarkable writer, and she's really fascinated in large theatrical ideas off the linear track. This is an adaptation, as I said, of a play by Nikolai Erdman, and that's unusual for her at the point that she did it in her career, and yet manages to evoke the sense of nonlinear mayhem without losing the audience or the inherent message. Knowing the play The Suicide as well as I do, it's remarkable what she has done. Logistically, she's trimmed the number of characters down from 20 plus to 12. And, you know, you'd think you'd lose a lot. There's a lot more talking in Nikolai Erdman's version, but nothing is lost in terms of the impact of what is talked about in The Suicide. And the way that she did that was by bringing the female characters forward. As you can imagine, in Russia in the 1920s, well, not limited to Russia in the late 1920s, but the women's voice is, you know, not forward. And there are many female characters in The Suicide, and they are compelling, but it is a very male-driven experience in Erdman's play. What Moira has done is brought Erdman's female characters forward and giving them more equal say and equal play within the story, putting some of the more subversive yet empowering political ideas in their mouths. And it's remarkable what it has done. It's at once very contemporary without losing any of the impact of the political intrigue that goes on in The Suicide. She's a terrific writer.
Timothy, I've heard that comedy can be difficult for actors, especially young actors. How do you address those challenges as a director?
For me, I'm useless at either acting or directing comedy, something that will make me laugh. What I have discovered for myself is my appreciation for Schadenfreude, that the misfortunes of others, shy of actual bodily harm, if I can watch and I have a perspective, I see exactly why that happened. I see why you slipped on that banana peel. You weren't looking. Or I can see the condition that causes someone like Semyon to decide, I'm going to shoot myself. But from my perspective, I'm like, dude, it's not that deep. But you're so serious. So for me, the difference between comedy and drama is it's drama plus one more level of intensity, one more level of a sense of hopelessness, and I'm going to just full speed ahead try to fix this thing. And in the audience, I sit back and I'm like, oh, but you don't have to, oh, what a mistake you're making. Because I have that perspective. I have that luxury sitting in the audience. As I said earlier, the actors are not playing for laughs. They're serious about what they're going for, but just a little too serious. And from my vantage point, I can laugh at that because I know nobody gets hurt. So I can laugh at that. But there's a sequence in the play where that's not true and the laughter is very uneasy. We don't know I don't want to give away too much, if the follow-through is going to happen. It remains a mystery.
Well, I want to get at that from the actor's perspective. What things beyond just, I'm going to memorize my lines, goes into preparing for dying for it?
And again, this varies with, you know, you get as many answers as the people that you ask, but it is investigating the play. You know, so we've read the play. We have a sense of what it's about. Now I have to get very specific about the role that I'm playing. And how did I get here to this situation? What motivates it? What the other characters, what they say about my characters, I have to really pay attention to that to help me form opinions about myself or certainly my motivations.
How does that spill out in, I'm sitting in the audience and I see that?
Well, you don't, and good that you don't see it. By the time it gets to you, all the seams have to have been disappeared and all the wrinkles ironed out. But we literally pull it apart. It's a Rubik's Cube of personal psychology. You know, I say it, it comes out of me with this inflection one time, and the literal vibration of my voice sends a tingle down my arm. I'm like, oh, what's that? And it suddenly shifts my body. And when I say it again, it's completely different. So I'm not just listening with my ear, but how does it make me feel when I say something like that? And then you, as my fellow actor, you come off with something. I never considered that. And when I was reading it on the page, I never considered that you would feel that way. Now that you feel that way, this makes me feel this way. It's investigating. It's play acting in that sense. But eventually something sticks. You know, we are creatures of habit and we are creatures of pleasure. And so I say a line this way and it just feels so full when it comes from me this way. So this is a keeper. And it's how that feels that actually inspires the memorization. I remember what it feels like to say this. And it's a chicken and egg thing. Is the line coming first or is the feeling coming first? Ideally, by the time it gets to you, it's in a perfect balance. I mean, that was very specific, but that's just one aspect of the process.
Well, I appreciate the specificity because therein you can begin to get an appreciation for all the effort that goes into that process. And I was drawn to the parallel in dance where it was Helen Simoneau was talking about her memorization of a choreography and how it is it's very feeling-based and a visual-based. And she basically creates a script.
Yes.
Through, I remember how that felt when I did that. And that's in the script. It's initially little disjointed memorizations, and suddenly they all tie together. And before you know it, there's a tapestry for the entire choreography.
Neurons in the brain are literally being formed in the process of rehearsing a play or a dance by that description. And the other thing I thought of for listeners, and you can relate, that you may have had an encounter with someone, usually it's an argument, and then you walk away and you think of all the things you could have and should have said, and it's so real. And some of us even say it out loud in our bathrooms. You know, we're actually having the conversation with the person not there. We actually get to practice that for real. So that's also part of the process. And as real as it feels to you and your listeners when you're engaged in that single dialogue, it's that real for the actors. And we have the benefit of having written text. Right? So we know where we're going, and that sort of inspires the hopefully unconscious bravery it requires to stand up in front of a bunch of people with the belief that I actually have something to say that you'd be interested in. Hmm. I mean, it's quite audacious when you think about it.
It is. Timothy, you've worked with professional theaters all over the country, and I'm going to read out a few. Cleveland Playhouse, Guthrie Theater, Milwaukee Rep, Steppenwolf, just to name a few. So what are some of the similarities and differences in working with directing actors in training versus actors in the professional realm?
Well, the greatest thing for me about working with actors still in the process of becoming is they say yes to everything. I ask them to try something and, you know, I say jump, they say how high. It's a beautiful thing. Not that I'm a total control freak. Directors by nature are control freaks, but I like to believe I listen and I keep in dialogue with the actors. It's very important for me. The actors keep feeding back to me how it's going for them, you know, how the stimulus is firing up in a given moment. With the pros, and I still act occasionally, and, you know, we think we know. We know, we've been through it, I know. And so when I, as a director, I say, would you try this? You know, there's this look, well, why? Why would I try that? You know, that's kid stuff. And then it's a negotiation, and then I get them to try it, and they think, oh, all right. So what's great about coming back to actors still in the process of becoming, and I do at least one production a year, is that yes factor. Because they're so willing, when I'm talking, I'm not trying to convince them to try something. I'm actually filling in. And it pulls out of me things that I've learned along the way that I didn't even know I learned because I never get to it because I'm negotiating with the pros. And as a result, when I go back to working with the pros, I'm far more patient and I'm willing to have the negotiation because ultimately, they just need to feel heard and be heard and have their experiences validated. So there was a time where I wasn't working so much with young actors, and certain patterns set up in rehearsal processes, actors I worked with before, and I find myself cutting them off in mid-sentence because I believe I know what they're going to ask and I try to shortcut it. What young actors teach me is that I don't know where they're going, or actually the discussion is not that long. They just say, okay, I'll try that, and we discover together why that works. When I go back with the pros and they're in the middle of a sentence and I find myself wanting to preempt them, I realize, oh, wait, let them finish. Because maybe there is something there that I haven't thought of. And David, that's always true. And even though the conversation is longer, because we really understand where the other one is, I'm actually buying more time for rehearsal. There's less confusion down the line. And I learned that lesson over and over again working with young actors, and specifically these actors at North Carolina School of the Arts.
That's a great lesson. It's so easy to not do that, because you're and I love the fact that you're actually saving time by not what you think is cutting them off and saving time and getting right to the meat of the matter, but in giving them that validation, you've solved the problem for them somehow, and you're able to move on.
And in a very non-aggressive way, I break my own destructive patterns.
Well, Timothy Douglas, thanks so much for talking with me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a joy.
UNC School of the Arts School of Drama faculty Timothy Douglas. Dying for It by Moira Buffini was based on Nikolai Erdmann's story, The Suicide, which was banned by Stalin and neither read nor performed there until 1982. Dying for It continues through December 7th at Patrons Theater Performance Place on the UNCSA campus. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we've got lots of show left this hour. First up, did you know that in the United States over the past 40 years or so, the average size of a single-family home grew from about 1,700 square feet to 2,500 square feet today? Meanwhile, the average family size actually went down. Well, if those facts strike you as a bit odd, they certainly don't sit well with filmmakers Alexis Stevens and Christian Parsons. After this short break, they'll be here with Bethany Chafin encouraging folks to think big, build small during their tiny house expedition next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Later this hour, the incredible saxophonist Wally West gets all kinds of wonky with me as we explore the Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra. And Pushcart Prize nominee and Emma Bell's Miles Prize-winning author Jeremy B. Jones shares his personal history of a mountain homeland with Bethany Chafin. But first, here's Bethany with a look at homes that might just surprise you.
Filmmakers Alexis Stevens and Christian Parsons are the individuals behind Tiny House Expedition. They're encouraging community members to think big, build small. In 2015, the couple will embark on a documentary adventure, taking their newly built tiny house, vehicle, and cameras, and documenting the tiny house movement across the country. They'll be visiting tiny house villages for the homeless and communities using tiny houses for neighborhood revitalization. Alexis and Christian recently stopped by WFDD.
A tiny house is a house that's under 400 square feet, and they come in all shapes and sizes. The tiny house movement, simply put, is a social movement where people are downsizing. They're choosing to live on a smaller, simpler scale, and the tiny house is the way to do that, and it provides many benefits, including financial freedom and less stress and greater connection to the community.
Now, just as a comparison, I've read that the average American home is about 2,600 square feet. Do you know if that's right?
That's right. So this is a small fraction of that size.
So for comparison's sake, is there anything size-wise that one might be able to compare and imagine in their mind? You walk in and it's about this size space.
Well, if you've ever seen a shipping container, a regular size shipping container would probably be about a mid-sized tiny house.
Okay. Are there different types of tiny houses? I mean, some are mobile, some maybe are set on a piece of land that someone purchases or a different foundation. What types are out there?
There's so many kinds of tiny houses. It's really fun. You can lose a lot of time on Pinterest looking at tiny houses. But the kind of tiny house that we're doing is a tiny house on wheels. Tiny houses on wheels are normally under 200 square feet, and it's built on a trailer. And that could be mobile. It's also a gray zone for building codes and zoning. But then you have tiny houses on foundations that can be very traditional, looking with gabled roofs, or very modern. You can do container homes. You know, you can put a green roof on it. You can stack them. Tiny houses come in as many ways as you can imagine them, just in small packages.
Cool. Well, you all are the couple behind Tiny House Expedition. Could you tell me about this project and what the purpose of it is?
Yes, Tiny House Expedition is a community outreach and documentary storytelling project. And we're seeking to inspire positive community building and promote awareness of tiny houses as an economically and environmentally sustainable housing solution. And this is for the everyman or homeless person. But what we're specifically doing is we're building our tiny house right now on wheels. It's 131 square feet, and when we're done, we're going to be taking it across the state and across the nation to do a documentary about tiny house community building. So this includes tiny house community building projects that are villages for the homeless, neighborhood and small town revitalization efforts, and we want to tell the story of how these people are making a difference in their communities, and along the way, share what we're learning with other communities.
Well, I want to get a little bit more into the details of what you'll be doing on the road. But let me ask kind of where the idea started. And Christian, I understand that Alexis pitched this to you a little bit ago. And were you interested in tiny houses before that?
Yes, I was. It kind of started with teardrop trailers. I've been really interested in teardrop trailers, which would be considered very micro compared to a tiny house. You just build it yourself, and it's mostly for camping, road tripping. Then I introduced Alexis to this thing. I was like, oh, there's these tiny houses out there, you know, check this out. And she absolutely fell in love with it. So we just started kicking around the idea of doing a project, and she eventually pitched me a project, which went out while I was living still in Brooklyn. And it was so good that I was like, yes, we have to do this. We have to make it happen. I'll move down, which I did in July. And ever since then, we've been working on it. It's changed a little bit here and there, which is great. But it's turned into this really big thing that's going to probably take more than a year, year and a half to accomplish.
And where are you all in that process right now?
So currently, we're building our house. We're putting up walls right now on the tiny house. And we're looking to complete the house in January. And we actually have a couple upcoming community build days, December 6th and December 7th, where we're inviting folks out who've expressed an interest in helping to build. And we're also going to do a nice barbecue and have some great conversation around tiny houses. So once the house is complete, we'll be ready to visit Asheville and Raleigh and then D.C.
I understand you had recently a community roundtable event, is that right?
Yeah, Think Big, Build Small roundtable at Flywheel down in the Innovation Quarter. Wonderful evening. The great thing about the group who came is they were between ages like 20 and 60, just heard about tiny houses, who built a tiny house. So a really great mix of folks, real estate agents even. And we discussed tiny houses as the future of housing and opportunities to bring tiny houses to Winston-Salem, which is the city of arts and innovation. Also kind of got into some of the thoughts about, you know, what would it be like to have a tiny house neighbor? Or, you know, what are some of the obstacles and that sort of things? And it was a very healthy discussion.
So you mentioned the types of people who were coming to this event, and they're coming from kind of diverse perspectives. Are there any standard like demographics for tiny houses that you know of? Like, do more women tend to live in them, or men, or a certain age group? Or is it appealing to kind of anyone and everyone?
I wish it was appealing to everyone. That's one thing it's not. But there is a big demographic of single women that that not only want to live in these, but they'll build them themselves, you know, usually with some help. But
yeah, I think part of that comes from it's such a self-empowering movement. Mm-hmm. You know, you can by yourself or with help build a house of your own and take your life into your own hands. I think that's very attractive. I think you're seeing a large group of millennials who are interested in this, who maybe don't buy into the old script, you know, of hitting all these milestones of collecting debt and are looking for a simpler life and some financial stability. And then I think this appeals to the aging populations, a great retirement option. But there is a wide range appeal because it's low cost, affordable quality housing. So whether this is you're living in this house for 2 years or 20 years, you're going to be able to save some money and get back on your feet.
What do you think is a trait, like a character trait that's important to have going into this journey, this adventure? Do you know? Or
Yeah, maybe bravery, open mind. I was incredibly inspired by these different community projects across the nation, and I just had the desire to go be a part of them. And being able to tell their story makes me feel very honored. But definitely going to places I've never been to and talking to a lot of people I've never met. So I've definitely, both of us have jumped 2 feet in and just being very brave. And I think that's most important, and positive thinking, because this whole trip we're going to be talking to people who we're hoping to help and inspire. So having positive attitude is the key to having folks embrace what you're trying to tell them.
Definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can tell you guys both have a positive attitude. Yeah. It's pretty cool to see.
Yeah. It's definitely, you know, we're we're doing something that's definitely not the norm. Even in the tiny house community, it's not the norm to travel so much with the house. Mm-hmm. So doing that, we've put an extra burden kind of on ourselves. But just going into a smaller house, you do have to be, like Alexa said, a bit brave and just willing to try something different. And, you know, some things are going to be hard for sure. Mm-hmm. But I think in the long run, we're going to get time. You know, we're going to get time to do other things that we really want to do because we're living in something that's so small.
Alexis, you're talking about some community engagement and some communities across the country that are already engaging with the tiny house idea in really interesting ways. And although this is somewhat out of the norm, the tiny house has some really practical uses. What are some of the uses that communities are finding for these spaces, and why are they so inspiring?
Great question. There are so many great projects for tiny houses. A couple of my favorites include Spur, Texas. And as a native Texan, I'm very tickled by them. They declared themselves the nation's first tiny house friendly town. And so they shared a proclamation declaring this, but they were able to update their building and zoning codes to allow for tiny homes. But they're doing this as a small town revitalization effort, which is very interesting. The folks who live there love their town, very proud of it. They have infrastructure to support 9,000 people, but they only have 300 residents, very small. You know, a lot of young people as they graduate high school are leaving town, and they want to encourage people to come in. So tiny housers, come here. You can build or park your house here, and you'll be embraced by the community. And as a side benefit, the folks who live in tiny houses tend to be probably the right sort of folks that they're looking for. Genuine, hardworking, open-minded folks. And there are many inspiring tiny house projects to help homeless. And many of these embrace like a habitat model of having the person who's going to live in the tiny home, part of the building process, like a sweat equity kind of thing. But one of the most inspiring is Opportunity Village Eugene in Oregon. And they have a tiny house village that has 30 houses. It's transitional housing where they have a common area where folks can have, you know, they have peer support, skill building, a lot of resources, self-governed village. This village used to be a tent city. Well, these folks have experienced no crime or any little crime that's come up they've dealt with very easily. And they've been so successful that they're now building a second village that's permanent housing where the people who live there have the opportunity to buy their tiny house by making small payments. So truly a great opportunity for home ownership for folks who wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity.
That's great. And one of the communities addressing homelessness in this way is actually in Greensboro. Is that right?
Correct. Tiny House Greensboro is a brand new project. They're in the very early stages of collaborating with their community, and they seek to serve the homeless people in Greensboro. Right now, they are building a tiny house prototype, which will eventually go to a person experiencing homelessness. But this is also an opportunity to show their local community what it's all about and how it could work and how it could fit in there. So they have a long road ahead of them, possibly of working with their city planners to get this approved, but very exciting. They've had a lot of folks rally behind them and growing numbers. So on our way back from our cross-country trip, we're going to be checking in with them to see how far along they've come.
And we had an opportunity to go over there and do a little documentary work and film part of a build that they did. Great. And, you know, the idea is to come back around when we're done with our trip, when we get to the end, mm-hmm. and see where they've actually gone in a year and a half, 2 years.
So how did you choose the places you're going to go? Have you mapped out your route completely, or are you leaving
very,
it
very
open?
Roughly.
Okay. Yeah, our list of destinations seems to be growing. Probably about 30 places we've picked out. And these include about a handful of established tiny house villages for the homeless, other projects like Tiny House Project in Pittsburgh, several in Texas. So we're looking for places that have a big hotbed of tiny houses, particularly in the community setting? And then also along the way, what are communities who may be experiencing a lot of homelessness where this could be discussed? And also there's just the opportunity between point A and point B of these tiny house villages. There's many places we're going to be traveling through, so a lot of opportunity to educate and inspire. And we're certainly going to be eye-catching.
Yeah, I was going to say, you'll definitely be having some great conversations just by the nature of what you're doing and the fact that it's visible and mobile. In terms of documenting this experience, how do you envision being able to capture this experience and tell this story with your respective trades, you know, of both kind of still photography and then the moving image of film? Are they going to tell different stories, or are they going to kind of go together to tell the complete tale?
They're going to work really well together to tell this holistic story, but individually, they'll provide different angles, different perspectives. Christian and I are a fantastic partnership. He's got this great filmmaking, still and video background, and I have a producing background. So together, kind of make a power team. But yeah, we're going to be telling our story through blogging. We'll be sharing little bits of stories along the way, included on our blog. But then social media is great for connecting directly with people and as a way to share stories as they're happening or shortly thereafter. And so people will get to see different aspects of what we're doing through these different mediums, and then all culminating into our documentary feature film.
Filmmakers Alexis Stevens and Christian Parsons. They're the duo behind Tiny House Expedition. The two will be holding community build days December 6th and December 7th, so you can join Alexis and Christian and help them construct their new home, enjoy some barbecue, and engage in discussion on the subject of tiny houses. The couple anticipates finishing their home in January of 2015 and hitting the road soon after. For more information on how you can be involved and how you can follow Tiny House Expedition, visit our website at WFDD.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Associate producer Bethany Chafin. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Bethany will be back just about 60 seconds from now with another look at home and identity. Bear Wallow, A Personal History of a Mountain Homeland, is up next with author Jeremy B. Jones. And we've got some burning jazz on the way, too, with local legend, the great saxophonist Wally West. He's keeping his reeds wet and his instrument warm in the Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra next when Triad Arts Weekend continues after this short intermission. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and did you know that the Triad is home to not one, but two amazing, absolutely burning big bands? It's incredible, but true. In Winston-Salem, it's the Camel City Jazz Orchestra, and in Greensboro, it's the Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra. The great saxophonist Wally West is here with the Gate City Jazz Orchestra update, but first, associate producer Bethany Chafin takes us back home to the Blue Ridge with an award-winning author and native son.
In Bear Wallow, A Personal History of a Mountain Homeland, author Jeremy B. Jones documents his and his wife's return to their native Blue Ridge Mountains. After arriving back in Edneyville, North Carolina, Jones took a job at his old elementary school as an ESL teacher, and the couple settled near land that Jones's family had inhabited for 200 years. Exploring the pull that one feels towards their home, the memoir documents how landscape shapes identity. Jones details the nuance of language, outlines the complicated and contemporary debates over land usage, and details historical events. Of Bear Wallow, author Ron Rash has said, it is a book to be savored. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with language, because you come back and you're working as an ESL teacher. So add Spanish into the mix, and you've got a really interesting conversation about language. What were some of your observations?
I think I started kind of intuitively noticing, and then later more overtly noticing, that language and accent particularly could place people into groups in the area that I come from, especially in an educational setting. So I realized at some point that the guys with the thickest accents were often the guys down on the vocational hall who were in the auto shop classes or the carpentry classes. And there seemed to be this kind of delineation of the way that you speak is going to predict your future. And I'm not sure that that should be the case, but maybe that's the way the world sometimes works. And so as a teenager, I decided that I was going to start cleaning up my language, because I was interested in literature and art and going to college. And to me at the time, those things didn't seem like they could connect or that they often did. And so I worked at first in a kind of probably, again, intuitive way, and then later in a kind of systematic way to start shaping up my language and maybe losing some of my accent, changing the way that I pronounce words, and continued that kind of through college. I was an English major and became a grammar geek, I guess. And then moving to Central America and spending most of my days speaking Spanish, I realized that when I was in that place, I was trying really hard to develop a colloquial language. I wanted to sound like everyone around me. I didn't want to sound like a textbook when I was speaking Spanish. And it started leading to a lot of questions about the beauty of the language and the accent of the region that I come from. And when I moved back, the year that the book takes place, I have to kind of deal with having lost, with having worked to lose that accent, and in some ways losing the beauty of that language, and also potentially losing some identity. But it's a hard process to try to reclaim those sounds when you've sort of moved on, you've found a new voice.
Do you have any favorite words as far as the sound? Any words you find really particularly beautiful in the way that they are used where you're from, and words that you sort of reclaimed when you came back?
Yeah, I really like the word reckon and all of its uses. And it's a word that I don't feel like I can reclaim. I don't feel like I can pull it off anymore, even though my family says it. And in fact, I was just in Chattanooga a couple weeks ago and talking to a professor there who teaches fiction, who was from Chicago. And he said when he first moved to Chattanooga, his students were writing stories and they had their characters using words like reckon. And he was like, people don't really speak like that. You have to make this realistic. And he didn't realize that people really do in this region. His students had to sort of school him on the accuracies of the dialect. So that's a word that I think has just cool layers of meaning about if it's a guess or sort of estimate and ways of softening phrases. And I really like the phrase, like to. Someone threw a ball at me and it liked to hit me. This kind of almost thing. That's another one that I don't feel like I can pull off, but it's such a colorful expression. We were talking about Ron Rash earlier, and he came to visit one of my classes a couple of weeks ago and was talking about language and saying that one of the things that's always been curious to him is that there is this stigma attached to a particularly Appalachian dialect, but what he's always been intrigued by are the ways that people use the language metaphorically. And to be able to use language metaphorically already implies a certain level of intelligence. So to be able to make those comparisons and to think in figurative ways. I find, now that I'm kind of back here and listening, that the language of this region is just filled with metaphor. It's a sort of constant comparison, and there are just tons of phrases like that.
In researching some of your family background, I think you do a nice job of showing that you really found individuals on both sides of a lot of these conflicts, the Civil War and the Trail of Tears and things like that. And how did that strike you when you discovered some of those things?
Well, I mean, like I said at the beginning of our conversation, I ask a lot of questions in the book, and I'm not sure how many answers I'm able to get to. But the bigger kind of guiding question of what does it mean to be a mountain person probably has a very long and complicated answer that I haven't quite sorted out. But one of the potential answers to that question that I began to learn as I looked into the history is that for a long time, this place has been kind of comfortable with a certain complication. So there have been, as you say, kind of competing histories and competing narratives and competing communities that have coexisted in the region for years. And it's not as though everyone's sitting around singing Kumbaya, but they're all able to kind of stake out their lives on the land and live in a way that is productive. And so that was kind of surprising to me, because I think the prevailing narrative about Appalachia is that it's a very kind of homogenous place that has been isolated. And maybe there's a little truth to both of those things, but certainly not as much as I had been led to believe. And I started looking into my history and finding, as you say, people fighting on both sides of the war, people fighting for very different kinds of reasons. And this is true of both the Revolution and the Civil War. The book that I'm working on now is about the diaries of my great-great-great-great-grandfather that I discovered recently. And he took part in the Trail of Tears, took part in the first stage of what was called then the Cherokee Removal. but also wrote sermons for most of the people in the community. And it's just a really complicated history. But that complication could be really useful, I think, to then sort out what we do with it now, especially as we have maybe less violent but still equally competing urges about how we use our land and what community looks like. And I think that the more that we have a sense of how the place has been able to, as I say in the book, kind of make a home of two minds to be able to exist in the disconnect between these various histories, I think if we can do that, you know, today, we'll be all the better for it.
So you'll be in Greensboro in January, and part of the experience that someone will have when they go to see you at a reading is you will bring along your banjo, and specifically this is, it's called a saga banjo, is that correct?
Yeah, the banjo that I had when I was 24, so the year that the book takes place, was called a saga. The banjo is an older form, so most people are probably familiar with the bluegrass style of banjo, which has this kind of resonator built on the back that rolls the sounds around, and what's often called Scruggs style after Earl Scruggs, the kind of three-finger picking style. I play an older form, so my banjo doesn't have a resonator. It's open back, and I play what's often called clawhammer or frailing on the banjo. So a lot of the songs are kind of pre-bluegrass songs, and many of them reach pretty far back into Appalachia and even all the way back to Scotland and Ireland. So what I've been doing for these readings is reading a bit from the book, but for me, our history is tied to music, and in many cases, the music helped me to understand the history, and so I've been playing a little bit from the banjo as a way of kind of nuancing that history and also my experience with it. When I moved back, I was trying to figure out if I really fit in that place, and so I decided, what more of an Appalachian thing could I do than buy a banjo and try to figure out how to play it? That suddenly kind of, not backfired, but I think complicated again the question, because I started learning that the banjo's roots actually reach into West Africa, and it was shaped by slavery and a lot of other factors before it became the instrument we know today. So even it has a very complicated history.
If you had been born somewhere else, would you have still felt this pull? Or is that pull unique to these mountains? Or, you know, is there something in you that is wired to want to understand place and its influence over who we are as people?
I think that, I mean, I hope that the book can communicate beyond the region, because I suspect that a lot of people have a very similar experience of leaving the place they're from and then suddenly asking lots of questions about it once they're gone. And those end up being kind of personal questions about how that place has shaped you and who you are. And so I find that, I don't know that it's unique to the mountains. I think what makes it, my experience maybe potentially different, and people who come from the region different, is that the mountains have so much kind of mystery around them. People are interested in them, but sometimes confused about them. And a lot of that has to do with prevailing stereotypes, I think, about people from the mountains. And this might be true, too, of say, the Ozarks, you know, in a very different part of the country, that mountains have been, in some ways, historically kind of separated from the rest of the world. And so the history there is harder to understand. And I think that it makes people a little more, maybe this is one of those stereotypes that has some truth to it. People are a little more standoffish about outsiders, but pretty connected to their community and their place. And so I think looking over the last 230 years that my family has been basically in Henderson County, it's easy to see that they abide, that they're very attached to that land. And I think that there are lots of places probably in the country and the world in which people have similar sentiments. But I think for the mountain region, there's this kind of like mystery that is hard to communicate once you get outside of it that sometimes sends people back.
Author Jeremy B. Jones, He holds an MFA in nonfiction writing from the University of Iowa. His essays have been recognized in Best American Essays, nominated for the Pushcart Prize, and awarded the Emma Bell Miles Prize. He currently teaches in the English department at Western Carolina University. In the new year, Jeremy will be reading and likely playing the banjo at Scuppernong Books on January 23rd at 7 p.m. Bearwalla was published by John F. Blair Publisher, an entity celebrating its 60th anniversary this year. To hear Jeremy read from Bearwalla, head to our website at wfdd.org. Once you're there, click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Associate producer Bethany Chafin. I'm David Ford. This is Triad Arts Weekend, and I'd say it's about time for some hot jazz. One of our state's newest big bands will be swinging this weekend in our neck of the woods, and you're going to want to check them out. The Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra, PTJO, calls Greensboro home, and soon they'll be collaborating with area high school jazz programs, offering residencies, master classes, and reduced fees to bi-monthly concerts in town. The outstanding PTJO musicians hail from the big bands of Wynton Marsalis, Harry Connick Jr., and the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra, just to name a few. We're sampling from the orchestra now. PTJO co-founder and one of today's leading tenor saxophonists, Wally West.
I think the sound of the big band is something that, when I first heard, it touched me in such a way because I had never heard anything like that before. I remember hearing Duke Ellington's band for the very first time on a recording, and what was typically known as a 15-piece big band all of a sudden to me sounded like a 75-piece orchestra. The writing and the arranging that was done by Duke Ellington touched me in such a way that no other big band had. Now, with that being said, I also love the traditional big band sounds of the Tommy Dorsey Band, the Glenn Miller Band, the Count Basie Band, the Stan Kenton Band, the Woody Herman Band. Each one of those bands had an exciting flair that was unique to their own persona. Each one of those has its own unique presence that hits you like a ton of bricks. The PTJO is a group of musicians that are all from North Carolina. These guys are primarily college professors, professional jazz musicians. The group is so good that we can read a chart for the first time and have it at 90%. You know, to the common person who is not a musician, that might not mean a lot, but the rehearsal time that we spend is primarily spent on nitpicking rather than laying serious groundwork. It's scary how good this band is. The talent level is off the charts. I'm hanging on for dear life. I'm glad to be in the band. My co-founder, Chad Eby, he's a genius. He put most of the band personnel together. These are all local musicians, but they play on such a high level, and it's an honor and a privilege to be in a band with such immense talent. We do this as a labor of love. It's something that is part of us. It's in our fabric of who we are as musicians, and we do it for the love of the music and for the we're passing the torch. We're mediators. We keep that sound going. We're not a non-profit organization. We're strictly grassroots. We're self-supportive. The guys that live in Charlotte, they drive up for the rehearsals. We don't pay anybody for the rehearsals. We're not even able to give up any gas money or anything. We do it because we love it, and it's for the sake of the art. So we're incredibly pleased that we get such a high level of talent in there that believes in what we do and the focus that we try to have in presenting what we have to offer to our audiences.
Piedmont Triad Jazz Orchestra co-founder, tenor saxophonist Wally West. PTJO recently performed for their peers during the North Carolina Music Educators Conference in Winston-Salem. On Sunday night, December 7th at 7:30, it'll be the PTJO Holiday Concert at The Crown at the Carolina Theater in Greensboro. You'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. You know, the winter holidays are fast upon us, and that can only mean one thing. You guessed it, Triad Holiday Celebration. It's a full hour of music, poetry, and short stories all about the holiday season, only by Triad musicians and authors. So, if you've got a song or story about the winter holidays that you'd like to share with WFDD listeners, please send me your MP3 recordings to triadarts@wfu.edu by midnight, December 11th. Please keep your poem, short story, or dramatic reading to no more than 5 minutes. And this year, we'll air Triad Holiday Celebration Part 1 on Friday, December 19th at 1 o'clock and Sunday at 4. We'll broadcast Part 2 the following Friday and Sunday at the same times. Again, the email address for your MP3 is triadarts@wfu.edu, and the deadline is midnight, Thursday, December 11th. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And our intern is Jorge Clifton. You'll find podcasts and photos for all the artists and events featured on the show, as well as archived episodes there at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.